We welcome you this Wednesday evening for our adult Bible study. As mentioned, we are right at the start of this brief look at the minor prophet Habakkuk, a series entitled Living by Faith. Please take your Bible and open to Habakkuk. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. And as you make your way to Habakkuk, let's ask for the Lord's blessing upon our time tonight as we consider the unique message of this book. Father in heaven, we bow before you, thankful that we can gather with your people in the middle of this week, to already be reminded, if we've sung to you and to one another, of your great love displayed in and through your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. We are thankful that we have such a great God and a mighty Savior, that soon we will remember with what he endured on the cross in our place, and then how he rose again on the third day, now is at your right hand, how he's promised to keep all who are his own. We are thankful for this great shepherd of the sheep. So Lord, tonight as we come to study your word, we ask that you would open up our eyes to behold what your word says, that we might understand it, that we might have a greater understanding of who you are, that you might even settle us amidst the challenges we presently are walking through, that we would better understand how we can live by faith in you, the one true God. We want all to be done for your glory and for your honor tonight. So Lord, receive all of this as an act of worship as we teach and as we hear your word taught. We ask this for Christ's sake. Amen. Habakkuk. If you are a very committed fan of America's favorite pastime, you may have woken up early this morning to track the first game of the baseball season for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Anyone in here, Dodgers fan? Maybe a few. Dodgers had their first game this morning, I believe, against the Padres. With baseball, they were doing a unique opening first few games of the season over in South Korea. So, different time zone, different location. The game was very early this morning at, I think it was off at 6 a.m. Dodgers won, if I saw the score correctly, and it sounds like there was a very odd thing that happened where one of the Padres players went to field the ball, and the ball broke through his baseball mitt. And because of that, there was an error, and the Dodgers were able to score a few runs. Dodgers won the game. Who knows if they'll win the World Series? We hope so. You're sitting here thinking, why is he talking about baseball? Well, think for a moment with me about baseball. Every player is important in baseball, no matter what position they play, and this comes up especially with the bullpen. It seems that with the increasing reliance upon analytics especially, managers are constantly thinking through, like a chess game, putting the proper pieces in place, the strengths of their bullpen. Now it seems so many of the pitchers in the bullpen, it's not that they're expected to go lengthy innings. They often are brought into very unique situations, and in that unique situation, they're called upon to deliver. Often those bullpen pitchers, they have their specialty, maybe one pitch especially that they're known for, where again, with the analytics, what the computers tell the managers, they rely upon that, thinking this would be a very good matchup. I know they've tweaked things in the last year or two, but they'll bring in a pitcher, he throws his pitch, a very unique setup, and then soon after that, they'll bring in the next bullpen pitcher. Those bullpen pitchers, they're different than the starters. Certainly, they're not expected to go as many innings as the starters. but each bullpen pitcher is significant and brings what is unique to the situation. Each one is needed, just like each one of the minor prophets. Again, they may not often be what we study. If we are honest, perhaps we go to our own favorite books of the Bible, and maybe not often that includes the minor prophets, the 12 all grouped together. They're not like the starting pitchers of the major prophets, major just because of the size and the length, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. But each one of these smaller prophets, though minor in size, they're certainly major in their message. You see in front of you tonight, living by faith. That's a very major message, something that we need to rightly grasp. And so with Habakkuk, we come for a few weeks to walk through this book, trying to make sense and understand what it is that's in this one book and even where it fits within all of the minor prophets. Again, we're heading into the Old Testament, further removed from our own place and time. Sometimes that creates larger gaps that as we study, we're trying to shrink the gap that we can understand the book in its proper context. And certainly last week, Pastor Hardy opened that up and began that for us with walking through the first 11 verses of chapter 1. Again, I trust you have Habakkuk open in front of you. We come to Habakkuk, not a lot of information is known about the book, not a lot of details are even given by this figure, Habakkuk. We know simply that his name means embrace, or you could think hug. But what he writes, it's a very unique message, and great burdens lie upon his heart. You piece details together, Habakkuk likely is communicating his book, his message to the nation of Judah with some very unique things that are happening that begin to be detailed in this opening section. Again, tonight, we're going to walk through the next section, but we want to, again, make another attempt to try to get our arms around the whole and even try to understand what is the lead up that prompts what's happening here. In fact, our study tonight, just by way of the info on the screen, verses chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 1, a prophetic rejoinder, or subtitled, How Faith Responds to Problems. Again, maybe just giving a brief overview of the book as a whole. You come to look at chapter 1 and chapter 2 together, it really is the prophet's problem. Related to two questions. Habakkuk, in his time, in his day, he's in Judah, more on that in a moment. He looks out amongst his fellow worshipers in the land of Judah. Again, the southern kingdom, Israel has split into two. He looks out at these people. They should be walking by faith. They should be committed to the law that God gave. But there's iniquity. There's sin. There's unfaithfulness. And Habakkuk is grieved over that. He looks out on the whole. He sees that there's compromise. He's even seen these faithless people prosper. And he asks this question in verses 2 through 4, Lord, why are you not acting? Why are these faithless people prospering? He says, why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists. Contention arises. The law is ignored. Justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. Great struggle, great turmoil. In fact, what even makes Habakkuk unique, so much of what is said here, it's Habakkuk and it's Habakkuk's God. We're getting the inner turmoil of this prophet. So many of the other prophetic books, God gives the message to the prophet, thus saith the Lord, go and make this pronouncement upon the nation. But at least as it begins, it's Habakkuk looking out at the nation, seeing how they're faithless, seeing how they're ignoring God's law. He's grieved over it, and he looks up to God, this inner turmoil of faith. Lord, why are you not acting? But then there's an answer. To this first question, God gives an answer, the first response, what we walked through last time, verses 5 through 11. And in fact, it's interesting, as you just read the flow of it, it's not automatically announced that God's speaking. Kind of as a detective, you're reading it closely and you begin to notice there's a shift in what's said. Suddenly someone's speaking very authoritatively and even communicating this. You need to share it with others around you. You look at verse 5, look among the nations. Observe, be astonished, wonder, because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. And surely to hear that, that grabs our attention, just like it grabbed Habakkuk's attention, this inner turmoil, and then to hear this announcement, look, be amazed, be astonished, wonder, you are not going to believe what I'm about to do. By the way, last week when Pastor Hardy was walking through that, I could not help but remember, and thus I have to share it tonight, many, many years ago, from this verse, maybe a good illustration where we need to remember the context, lest we take something and rip it out of its context and use it in a way that's not how it's intended to be used. Many, many years ago, at a different ministry, put it that way, I was with young people. We were all preparing for a mission trip to a very large city in the U.S. where we were going to go for about a week and minister evangelistically. Really, we were all excited about it. And I remember one of the leaders, again, as we were praying and preparing and he was building up the excitement, he shared with the group this very verse. As we were thinking about going out into that city, reaching the nations, how he said, oh, Habakkuk 1 verse 5, look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder. I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. And I remember hearing that, being excited about it, and many others in our group, we were excited about it. Though in context, what's being said here? What's this exciting thing that's about to take place? Does it have to do with world missions? Not quite. Again, good, faithful Bible study, we need to remember the context. Verse 6, behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. What's this astonishing thing that's going to take place? God is communicating to Habakkuk, I am raising up the Chaldeans, another way of referring to the Babylonians. I'm raising them up, and yes, a fierce and impetuous people. We're going to see a little bit more about them tonight. They are wicked. They are hostile. They are being raised up, and they are going to be the instrument to bring about punishment upon the nation. They're dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves, meaning they're a law to themselves. They have no respect for God and for His law. Their horses are swifter than leopards, keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swooping down to devour. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. They mock at kings, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. What is being said here? To Habakkuk's question, God gives this answer. Yes, Habakkuk, I see the faithlessness amongst the people. I see their disregard for my law. And here's how I'm going to act. Here's what I'm going to do. I am going to bring about righteous punishment by using this unrighteous people, the Babylonians. A fierce people, a hostile people, a wicked people. And that, for Habakkuk, would no doubt bring about terror. And we're going to see again in a little bit. That then prompts a second question that we're going to walk through in detail tonight in verses 12, really all the way into chapter 2, verse 1. That second question, then God will respond with another answer, first directly to Habakkuk, then further pronouncement upon the Babylonians. And then chapter 3, when we get there, the prophet's problem, we'll also walk through the prophet's prayer. Now, what's happening here as God even announces that he's raising up the Babylonians? Again, it may not hit us. We may not grasp totally what's taking place. And that's where tonight, again, Bible study. We have our Bibles open in front of us. We want to do a little bit of an extended detour to help ground ourselves in the Old Testament to understand why this shouldn't have taken him by surprise, and even how God long ago had announced what he would do to his people if they were not faithful to him. Can you put your finger in Habakkuk? Turn back to Exodus. Exodus chapter 19. Again, a little bit of a tour tonight, a detour, but the hope is it will help all of us better make sense of our Old Testament, which, by the way, is about 75% of our Bible. The more we understand the Old Testament, the more we grasp the flow and the narrative, the more that we can make sense as we walk through these individual books. You go to Exodus 19. Already for us to be in Exodus, we're remembering where the name even comes from, how God has brought out his people from the land of, what land? There we go, good. The land of Egypt. Israel had been enslaved in Egypt. You remember even how Genesis ends. At first, they head down into Egypt just as a family. But over 400 years, they blossom into this nation who are held captive by the Egyptians, by that harsh ruler Pharaoh. God, in a great act of salvation, brings about the deliverance of Israel, saves them out of Egypt while he simultaneously judges the Egyptians. He brings them out of Egypt. He brings them through the wilderness that they would go to Mount Sinai. And here at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19, very exciting things are about to take place. God is going to enter into a very unique relationship with the nation of Israel. A covenant is going to enter into effect. You look at Exodus 19, drop your eyes to verse 5. And part of this covenant, it's going to be different than other covenants that have shown up in the Bible thus far. What's said here is different than what God promises to Abraham. There back in Genesis, God promises things unconditionally. that God and God alone will be the faithful one to uphold what's promised. But here in Exodus 19, with Moses and the nation, if you look at verse 5, now then, what's that small word? If, meaning this is conditional. If you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then, you see that? If, then, conditional. Then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Do you see those three descriptions? Might be helpful in your Bible to underline them, because it's marking out why Israel is going to be very unique and special to God in this covenant. If you are faithful and if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you will be my own possession. You will be to me a kingdom of priests. You will be a holy nation. What do those terms mean? Israel singled out. You will be very unique to God, more than all the other nations on the earth. And no doubt provision for that's already been made back with Abraham. You will be a kingdom of priests. What are priests? People who intercede and go before God. A whole kingdom of priests means the nation, with how everything is going to be set up and how they worship and how they sacrifice and how they act, they are going to be the one nation who knows the Lord and by the way that they worship can draw the other people to the one true God. And a holy nation, holy meaning separate, set apart. How's that going to take place? Well, think of the law that God's about to give to Israel. You think of the book of Leviticus. You think of things that come up in Numbers. Even what's going to come up in just a moment here in Exodus. Very specific about how they are to worship. Very specific about how they are to eat, how they are to dress, how they are to go about life and business in the ancient world. All of that would be very different than all of the other nations. And thus, if you were part of any one of those other nations and you would come across Israel in the promised land, you'd look at them and you'd think, they seem different, they look different, they live different, because they're holy, they're set apart. And part of that was also they would draw the foreign people by the way that they lived, how they were different, to see them and then to look up and to behold their different God, the one true God. And this is for Israel, different than, jumping into the New Testament, how things operate for the church, a spiritual body. You see that, though, already in Exodus, that if then, if you obey me as a nation, here's what you will be in my eyes. Jump ahead then to Leviticus 26. You think Leviticus 26? I just did my devotions there this morning. That's wonderful, hopefully. Leviticus 26, and we'll give it to you also, Deuteronomy 27 and 28. In both of these places, you have spelled out very clearly blessings and curses. Covenant blessings and covenant curses. You remember that if then? If Israel obeys the law that God has given to her at Sinai, she will enjoy covenant blessings. As she lives in the promised land, she'll enjoy prosperity. She'll enjoy peace from her enemies. Things will go well with her in the promised land. However, if she disobeys, if she turns a deaf ear and a blind eye to God's law, what's going to happen? She's going to experience the covenant curses. They show up in Leviticus 26, verses 14 through 45, but specifically, drop your eye to verse 31. Verse 31, I will lay waste your cities as well and will make your sanctuaries desolate. I will not smell your soothing aromas. I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. You, however, what does he say? I will scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. You see that there? Very clearly, this warning, if you are disobedient, turning against God's law, there could come this curse where you will be scattered among the nations. What's that mean? Israel, you will be taken and uprooted out of the promised land. Jump over to Deuteronomy. You wonder, why is this repeated two times? Well, do you remember what happened to the first generation of the Israelites after they came out of Egypt? Did they believe in the Lord? Did they trust what he said? No, in their unbelief, they were afraid to go into the promised land. And because of that unbelief, God judged them and said, okay, this whole first generation, you're disqualified. You don't get to go into the promised land. The great tragedy, that even included Moses in Numbers and his disobedience. So now, after the whole generation dies out in the wilderness, and the second generation has come of age, as they're about to go into the promised land, Moses preaches and exposits what the law means. That's what all of Deuteronomy is. But in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, now a second time to the second generation, those covenant blessings and covenant curses are repeated. Look over into Deuteronomy 28. Drop down to verse 36. Again, if they disobey, persist in disobedience to God's law, very clearly it said, the Lord will bring you and your king, whom you set over you, where? To a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone. You shall become a whore, a proverb, and a taunt among all the people where the Lord drives you. Look down at verse 49. Again, if you persist in this disobedience, here's what's promised you, covenant curse. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth. As the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, who will have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young. That nation God will raise up to come against you and take you out of your promised land back to their nation. You will be removed out of the promised land, all as an act of punishment. I know this illustration isn't perfect, but you could think of it like this. God has given the promised land to Israel. Israel, you are to be the permanent tenant in this land. However, if you don't keep the terms of our contract, this covenant, be warned, you could be evicted out of the promised land. So what happens? Well, they head into the promised land. Eventually, they have a king, Saul first, then David, then Solomon. Then with Solomon, after he dies, his son Rehoboam becomes king. But do you remember what happens in the nation? Are they all at peace with one another? No, there's great turmoil such that the nation splits. The nation breaks into two. 10 tribes go with the north, and that becomes to be known as Israel. 2 tribes remain in the south. That's known as Judah. Yes, very good. So, what then happens? Well, think of 1 Kings and 2 Kings and all of those kings and how many of them are so bad and so wicked. And God raises up prophets who go to the kings and warn them. What are those prophets doing? It's as if they're coming, they're knocking the door. Knock, knock, knock. Be warned, be warned. If you don't obey the law, you're going to be punished and evicted. Does this happen? Yes. First in the north, Israel is evicted out of the promised land by means of the Assyrians. But what about the south? What about Judah? As they watch their brothers be removed in punishment, do they learn the lesson? Do they turn back to the Lord? Well, for a brief season, there's revival under King Josiah. But soon after he heads off the scene, the nation continues in disobedience. That's then what Habakkuk is observing. And God then answers Habakkuk, Habakkuk, it's now time. Judah has been unfaithful. She is now going to be evicted. Babylon is whom I have raised up to take them out of the promised land. That's what he says. He refers to them also as the Chaldeans. It calls to mind, you think back in Genesis, Abraham comes out of Ur of the Chaldeas. It's the region, modern day Iraq. And again, historically, you can see how this all happens. Assyria has been the major power, but Babylon rises up onto the scene, first with Nabopolassar, but then his son, you know him as Nebuchadnezzar. They historically go and they fight at the Battle of Carchemish. Babylon succeeds. She overthrows Assyria. She also overthrows Egypt. Babylon is now king of the hill. Babylon is the dominant power. And now Babylon will be used to bring about this punishment. That's what's happening big picture and on a more personal level. Habakkuk wrestles with this. He sees the wicked prospering. God answers him. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm raising up these Babylonians to bring about this punishment. But now that God has answered Habakkuk, Habakkuk responds to God's answer. That's where we get this sense of a rejoinder. Like a volley back to God. God, I now have a second question. I know you've answered me, but sometimes answers prompt more questions. Well, here's the second question. And that's where we come to now what we're mostly paying attention to in our study tonight. I know that was a long way of introduction, but we're trying to help you understand what's happening in the Old Testament. Tonight, let's walk through verses 12 through chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 1, okay? First up in this prophetic rejoinder, in verse 12, we simply hear God described. Habakkuk says, "Are you not from everlasting? O Yahweh, my God, my Holy One, we will not die. You, O Yahweh, have appointed them to judge. And you, O Rock, have established them to correct." He even continues in verse 13, "Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor." Oh, he hears God answer him. He hears what's going to happen to his people. Habakkuk then responds to God, and he rehearses to himself who God is. Again, he tries to set so clear to himself and to all who would read God and his very character. God's described here. He says first, "Are you not from everlasting? Aren't you the God who is eternal? The God who always is?" No doubt the God who in human history has demonstrated his kindness towards the nation of Israel, the God who has acted in the past towards Israel, even preserving and saving Israel out of Egypt. Are you not that everlasting one? Are you not, O Yahweh? Your translation likely has Lord in all caps. Yahweh, that unique covenant name for God, meaning I am who I am, the self-existent, eternal one, the one who is independent, not needing anything, but who in a unique way to his covenant people will show loyal, faithful love. Isn't that who you are? Are you not my God, my sovereign, my creator? Are you not my Holy One? The one who is separate and other and different, the one who thus is perfect, pure, undefiled, upright, as John will even tell us in 1 John, the God who is light and in whom is no darkness at all. Are you not the rock, the one who is stable, the one who is secure, the one who is unchanging, the one whom his people can rely on, the place of security, the place of stability? In fact, rehearsing these things, Habakkuk even throws in the comment about himself, "We will not die," as if his belief in what God has promised, yes, God is going to punish and take them out of the promised land, but God isn't going to abandon his people finally and forever. God will still be a covenant, faithful God, and even has promised how he will bring them back one day to the promised land. He describes God here. He goes further in verse 13. Again, "Your eyes, they're too pure to approve evil." So perfect, so pure, in no way could you look upon sin and iniquity and give it the thumbs up. You can't look on wickedness with favor. Habakkuk describes God, reminding himself who God is, but he then brings this to bear upon the problem at hand. From his perspective, he is asking God, "God, if that's who you are, then how is it that you are going to actively use the wicked Babylonians to punish your people?" He then moves to describe Babylon. And for him, there's this real tension. It's as if God, isn't this guilt by association? Isn't this going to defile you? I mean, I know that you're everlasting. I know that you're holy. I know that you are this rock. But what do you mean that you're raising up the Chaldeans? It's as if from his perspective, he asks, why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? I mean, put yourself in his shoes. He's lamenting the faithlessness amongst his people, but as he hears what God's about to do, he's struggling. God, what do you mean you're going to use the Babylonians? You're going to use the bad guys against the good guys, the people of Israel? That's not adding up to me. You know who these Babylonians are, right? He says, you've made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them. Again, from his perspective, how Babylon is going to treat his people just as they've treated all of the other people that they've conquered, he raises this issue with God. God, you know what they're going to do to us. You know how they view us. They don't view us as human. They look at us as if we're fish in the sea, as if we're worms in the ground, easily plucked up and exploited. I mean, after all, verse 15, here's what the Babylonians do. They bring all of them up with a hook. They drag them away with their net. They gather them together in their fishing net. Saying, God, that's what they're about to do to us, your people. I mean, you get the imagery here? Maybe it helps to think of commercial fishing. It's said that the most caught fish in commercial fishing in North America is the Alaskan pollock. That most of the fish products that you might enjoy and purchase at the grocery store in one way or another come back to this fish, the Alaskan pollock. You can look up a vessel known as the Northern Eagle, a massive vessel, the whole vessel dedicated to catching, processing, freezing Alaskan pollock. You can think fish sticks. Any fans of fillet of fish? Maybe a few. Maybe you don't want to admit it. That's okay. I mean, truly, you can look up this vessel on YouTube. Massive net that they let out. And as it fills up with the pollock, they begin to pull it on board. How big? It can hold up to 200 tons of just this one fish. They bring it all on board, they let loose the net, and all those fish begin to pour out, unloaded all over the deck of this massive vessel, all just flopping around the massive quantity, all to just be brought below, beneath the ship for processing. I mean, just like an easy process. The workers there going about how they've just captured all those fish. And Habakkuk is saying, God, that's how they're going to treat us, as if we're nothing. Men who are made in God's image to be caught and treated as if we're just commercial fish. And in fact, literally, you go back in the historical records, the Babylonians, when they would conquer people to show their power and humiliate their captives, they would even take a hook, plunge it through the captive's lower lip, and string them along like their captured trophy, showing no pity to the defeated. And he says, as they do this, verse 15, they rejoice and are glad. When those two terms are brought together, it's always communicating worship connotation. That it's not just their job, this is their life, their worship. In fact, they offer a sacrifice to their net. They burn incense to their fishing net because through these things their catch is large, their food is plentiful. They bow down, they worship, they offer up praise in their pagan worship to themselves, to their false gods, boasting in their strength and in their might. He again asks, will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? For Habakkuk, this is a real problem. It just does not add up to him. God is described, Babylonians are described, then Habakkuk will describe himself. What's he going to do? Verse 1 of chapter 2, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart. I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. How does he describe himself? He's going to be the watchman. He's going to figuratively position himself awaiting God's response while he seeks to wait patiently and faithfully. Like a soldier on sentry duty, in an unremitting and undistracted way, waiting for the Lord's response. This is the prophet's rejoinder. You say, okay. You remember, though, how we intimated how personal Habakkuk is? Himself and his faith directly with the Lord. You know, in many ways, you can walk back through the account from a different perspective and begin to grasp how Habakkuk, with his faith, responds to this very real problem. Let's walk back through it and simply see how true faith responds to problems. Timeless things are on display here. No doubt we're not Habakkuk. We're not threatened by a foreign people like Babylon. We're not a theocratic covenant people in that way. And yet, faith is timeless. Living by faith is timeless. As he faces this problem, age-old problems, how is it that he responds? Well, first, as he described God, do you notice how really faith here recalls? Before he jumps into the problem at hand and tries to reason and work through the issue, he first recalls, you could even say rehearses to himself, reminds himself who his God is. We love this. Faith doesn't just start with the problem. Faith here, Habakkuk doesn't just begin with how he feels. He starts first with what he knows. He has to intentionally take a step back and remind himself who his God is. In fact, it's here that Martin Lloyd-Jones on this passage said, sometimes in the life of faith, you have to stop and think and restate basic principles. And that's what he does. All piled up in that verse, all those descriptions of God, faith recalls, faith remembers, faith rehearses, chiefly who God is, the one who is everlasting, the one who is the sovereign creator, the one who is holy, pure, perfect, and undefiled, the one who is a rock, a place of strength and security. Faith recalls, and then, second, faith reasons. After Habakkuk has recalled biblical truth, chiefly who God is, now he takes that truth and he applies it to his problem. Faith reasons. You could say faith wrestles. Faith thinks it through. Faith tries to make sense of the problem at hand after having reminded oneself of who God is, being settled and sure of that, then trying to process and work through the problem at hand. And no doubt often this is where we wrestle. We swim in deep waters. We're trying to find footing. We find that in who God is, but we move into our problem and we work through the issue and we wrestle and we wrestle and we reason and we reason. At the same time, remembering God does not owe you nor I an answer. Sometimes he doesn't give that to us. We're not entitled to that. That then leads third. Faith recalls, faith reasons, faith rests. In the imagery, him positioning himself as a watchman. The imagery here, when we use rest, it's not passive, it's very active. It's waiting on the Lord that was brought up last week. It's a beautiful way of saying trusting God. Faith recalls, faith reasons, faith rests. With whatever it is, the problem that arises, for Habakkuk, no doubt unique for his time and for his people. And we're going to see in coming weeks, again, how the Lord answers a second time. We can't steal Pastor Kevin's thunder, where God will be very clear how the righteous are to respond. But at least for now, in this initial rejoinder to God's first answer, I think we have a good model of how faith can act and respond and react when things aren't going according to plan.